very much a pleasure and an honor to welcome Rabbi Michael Broyd. It's always the honor, I'll get to in a moment, but the pleasure is that being able to introduce old friends and acquaintances from many years. I think we were in by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik together 35 years ago, from, back in 84, 85, and not quite 35 years, but and over the, you know, the course of the past 3.5 decades, so we have kept up the relationship and the connection. So it's very much a real pleasure to welcome again, because the Lord has spoken here before in the yeshiva. In this particular instance, so Rabbi Broyd has been on a sabbatical this year here in Israel, and very early on he let us know that he was going to be on the sabbatical, and he said, okay, we're going to definitely have to have you in the speak in the yeshiva. And well, one thing has led to another, and it's you know, here we are in the middle of ER, and we've finally been able to get that in. We've tried several times and just hasn't worked out on one side or the other in terms of the scheduling. In terms of the pleasure. So to bring Rabbi Broyd, it's always wonderful to have him here. In terms of the honor, so all you have to do is to very quickly, not now, Google Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd, and you will see both the scope of his erudition, whether it be within Rav Dayan, professor of law at Emory, author of I think it's 6 or 7 books at this point, and countless articles, blog posts, etc. Very much considered a leading authority on those issues of general halacha and specifically areas of halacha which go into Evin Ha'ezer and Choshen Mishpat, go into those areas of legal considerations where, especially when there is an interface with the outside world. And so it's a it's an honor to have him here with us today, and to be speaking, as we told you, we feel that it's very important, and that's why we may be the only yeshiva, I don't know, that decides that one of our Tiul days should be dedicated to understanding the legal workings of the modern state of Israel. And that's why tomorrow we'll be going to the Knesset and to the Beit Mishpat HaElyon. But it's not just a field trip to say, okay, here we are in Israel and we've been zocha to this malchut of having these branches of government for the first time in the better part of 2 millennia, but which is important of itself, but of course how to deal with that from a halachic Torah perspective, in terms of the authority of the state, how to understand the interplay between court and Beit Din, etc. And so to be able to have an expert on the field, like Rabbi Broyd, to be able to give you a shiur on this concept to begin, we'll be doing more to prepare you for this trip. So it's very much a great honor for us.
Thank you. I just want to start with a historical observation, which I think is really beyond dispute. The modern institutions of Israeli government that you're going to see tomorrow, whether it be from the Knesset or the Supreme Court, these are essentially Britishisms that are residing in Israeli society. They are not native to Yahadut in any way, shape, or form. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Indeed, the thrust of the shiur today is that when it comes to commercial matters, indigenous halacha is less important to us than indigenous halacha is in many, many, many other areas of our Jewish life. Hilchot Shabbat mostly revolves around things that are indigenous to Judaism. When Shabbat begins, when Shabbat ends, what malachot are permissible or prohibited, almost has nothing to do with the secular world around us. It doesn't change much whether we're under communist rule in China, or whether we're deep in the Soviet Union in a different era, or residing happily in the United States in a just Western government, or an autonomous Jewish community in the Ukraine, or a very autonomous Jewish nation in Israel. Hilchot Shabbat more or less exists on independent halachic terms. And the same thing is more or less true for Hilchot Shechita, Basar v'chalav. Most areas in Yoredeya exist independent of the legal norms around us. There are a few aspects of the rules of funeral where halacha acknowledges some relationship to civil society and governmental regulations. But in most areas of what we consider Jewish life and practice, we don't look around very much to determine what we're going to do. Governmental legislation which says to us Shabbat begins at this time would be ignored. It would be ignored. An act of the Knesset or of the United States Congress which says this is not a malacha on Yom Tov would have no impact on us in any way, shape, or form. And the same thing is true for many, many, many other areas, which is we don't pay a lot of attention in much of the nitty-gritty practice of Judaism to secular norms. But this is not true in what we colloquially call in the yeshiva choshen mishpat matters, commercial matters, business matters, economic matters between people, including, by the way, economic matters that govern families. A husband-wife economic relationship is also very much covered by this. Halacha has, and always has had, and it deeply grounds itself in the economic norms of a society around us, and it recognizes the authority of communities to govern commercial matters in a variety of different ways. The Shach sort of puts this in a very elegant way that deeply resonates. I step into a supermarket, I pick up a can of spaghetti intending to put it in my cart, it slips from my hand, it drops on the floor, and it breaks. So what's the custom in America when that happens? You've never been shopping. You pay for it. You said you've never been shopping. That's a good, reasonable answer, but it's not correct. What do you do? I'm sorry?
Right that you buy.
It's not true.
Take another.
You take another one. And what do? You sort of pretend it didn't happen. You walk away. And then you go to the cashier and you say, somebody dropped a can of spaghetti on aisle 6. You should send somebody to clean it up. The custom in America is accidental breakage in the supermarket is paid for by the supermarket. This is affirmed by what's called the Uniform Commercial Code in America, which says more or less it isn't mine until what?
Thanks.
I pay for it. I didn't pay for it. It's not mine. It's the supermarket's problem. Now, of course, I can't come in with a baseball bat to my supermarket and smash spaghetti cans because that's a tort. That's a hezek. That's an intentional damage. But when I accidentally damage a can of spaghetti sauce, I drop it and it shatters. I just sort of pretend I didn't do it. And I walk away slowly and I go tell the cashier that somebody dropped a can of spaghetti and they should clean it up. What's the halacha? The halacha is clear, which is when I picked up this can of spaghetti and it slipped from my hand, that's an act of negligence on my part. I might have been kone it when I picked it up. And when I broke it, it's my loss and I need to pay for it. The Shach, writing 400 years ago, was acutely aware of this difference because this was a difference in commercial law 400 years ago as well. And the Shach says, we, living in the Ukraine in the 1600s, live in an integrated economy, i.e. the Jews and the Gentiles are shopping in the same stores. So I can post a sign on the top of my store. Here's what my sign can say. If you're Jewish and you break it, you need to pay for it. But if you're not Jewish and you break it, it's on the house. Please come and identify what religion you are so that we can work this out. Or what can I post on the sign in my store when you come in?
Where do you buy it?
No. I post, we all do business according to Ukrainian law. The Shach already observes this, and the Shach notes, in this general way, that which we follow in America, which is we don't post a sign which says we all do business according to Ukrainian law. We post a sign which says, we all do business according to American law. That's what we do. You step into even a kosher store, and there's no sign which says we do business in accordance with Jewish law. The sign says, implicitly or explicitly, we all do business here according to the law of the land and the cultural norms of the United States. The Shach already notes this, that the general tradition among halachic communities in Ashkenaz is we do transactions according to secular law, particularly when I'm engaging in transactions in which I really want to do business with anybody who wants to pay me. That's who I want to do business with. I want to do business with anybody who wants to do business with me. And except for those rare kinds of transactions where I know for sure far in advance that everybody is an Orthodox Jew, we follow secular law. So when do we follow halacha, for example? When a synagogue hires a rabbi. Because Mistama, the rabbi, is Jewish. And Mistama, the synagogue, is too. It's rare to hire a non-Jewish rabbi. You know, it seems sort of anomalous. And it's rare for a rabbi to go work in a non-synagogue. Not so rare. Or when we buy and sell chametz, or when we buy lulavim. These are the kinds of objects which when you ask who's the buyer and who's the seller, the answer is it's only Orthodox Jewish transactions. But all commercial transactions that I sort of do with everybody. You come into my store, you have money. I don't want to inquire about what your ethnicity is. I want to inquire whether... Do you have the money? And that's the only thing we really inquire about. And there are all sorts of good reasons. This is true both in America and in Israel. When somebody comes to buy my house in Atlanta, Georgia, how do they buy my house? According to secular law. Why don't they do chazaka, like the Gemara tells me? Because it doesn't work according to American law. And it would only create terrible confusion if I sold my house to a Jew through the methods of sale described in the Mishnah, when that person came to sell their house to a non-Jew, because the Atlanta records wouldn't show... They would still show me as the owner and not the other person. So everybody buys and sells houses or cars, or anything else in accordance with secular law. So the institutions in Israel that are the holders of secular law are who? Who holds secular law here? The Knesset. The Knesset is the will of the people, writ broadly. They make secular law. The Supreme Court more or less interprets the law. And these two organs of government run, broadly speaking, commercial society in Israel. So when I want to buy a house in Israel, how do I buy a house? And how did the Knesset decide what property law should apply here? Does anybody know what property law, where the property law in Israel comes from? It's Turkish. The property law in Israel is Turkish because the Turks ruled here for hundreds of years. They established a property law system called the tabu. The tabu is a Turkish word for property records. And when I buy and sell property in Israel, I more or less buy according to Ottoman law from 100 years ago, because the Knesset said we'll just continue the system that was in place prior to the establishment of the state. For other matters, the Knesset stepped in and said, well, we'll follow British law. Every once in a while, Knesset stepped in and said, you know what we'll follow? Jewish law. Every once in a while, Knesset stepped in and said, here's an idea, let's try and bring back one aspect or another of halacha. What's an example of that in contemporary Israeli commercial society?
Conversion, marriage.
No, I'm not interested in discussing status. That's completely true, but conversion and marriage and divorce are not really commercial matters. It's true, but what's an area of commercial law that follows halacha?
Probably transport clothes.
Well, that's really a Shabbat issue. But what's a sort of a standard commercial law? What's the law in the United States when I find a wallet on the street?
Yours?
Yes, more or less, that's a quick summary of the law, and I have no duty to return it to its original owner. I find a wallet on the street, I don't have to return it. Not only that, I'm walking 5 feet behind you on the street, and your wallet falls out of your pocket. Do I need to scream out, hey you dropped your wallet? Nope. In Israel, there's a chok hashavat aveda, a law of Knesset which says that when you find a lost object, you need to return it. And it more or less follows the applications of halacha. It says you have to open the wallet and find out who it belongs to and reach out to them and contact them and say, hey, I have your wallet. I don't have to go to them. They have to come to me. It sort of follows halacha. There are other areas as well where the Knesset has chosen in its wisdom to defer to halacha on commercial matters. Okay. All of that is wonderful. The Knesset serves as the point at which people decide what are the economic norms that govern your society. This is more or less what the legislature here does. It decides what are the commercial norms that will govern your society. Halacha recognizes five ideas that temper, modify, and restrict how we apply halacha on a variety of matters. They're both public matters and private matters. And when you go to the Supreme Court or the Knesset tomorrow, you'll ask yourself, what is the tafkid of this institution from a halachic perspective? What's the role of this place? And the answer is very important. These governmental institutions serve the role of focusing the will of the people. In the old days, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, they used the term Zion Tuve Ha'ir in reference to this, but sort of now seven is not enough. And now what we have running in Israel is a Knesset. The Knesset serves as the place where people decide what ought to be the commercial norms in the society around us. Knesset does much more than that, of course. But the thing that the Knesset does that's most halachically relevant and gives it a purpose and a place according to halacha is the Knesset serves as the codifier of what will be the will of the people on commercial matters. It's a way of thinking about what is the minhag in the time and the place that we're going to function at. This is, by the way, helps you understand a unique and distinct difference, which is we learn a lot of Bava Kamma. We learn a lot of commercial law, but we more or less don't follow Talmudic commercial law for a variety of different matters day in and day out. And the reason why we don't follow it is because halacha recognizes that secular law norms can and do trump halacha all the time on commercial matters. So I guess we'll start with going through what these doctrines really are and explaining sort of how they impact on the normative practices in halacha. I'm going to skip treaties for now, which is the first thing on the handout, and we'll come back to it because treaties really deal with public law, but we will come back to it and note that there are two different enormously important principles that limit halacha. The first is minhag ha-sochrim, and the second is what we call private law. Minhag ha-sochrim is those situations in which business people have developed a common way of doing business that's not found in the halacha, but which everybody agrees is how we're going to do business. So the halacha is pretty clear that when I have a private condition that I impose on my transactions, even if my private condition violates halacha, if this is on a commercial matter, the private condition triumphs over the halacha. I want to give you a sort of a very classical example because it's well worth thinking about. The halacha is clear. When I want to plow my field and I put my horse in front of my plow and I start plowing, let's go back to pre-modern times, I cannot muzzle my horse. My horse can instead do what?
Graze.
It can eat. Great. That's wonderful. The Gemara learns from this as well that when I have workers who are plowing my field, you know what I can't do?
Muzzle them.
My workers are allowed to, while they're picking grapes, eat the grapes. And that there's a self-standing prohibition to muzzle my workers while they're eating. The Shulchan Aruch says, Poa ho'osa melacha l'balabayit bedavar macha, with a food item, hareza och limashu osa, afil enu osa lo biyadav lo baragrav, lakshinosa al kefo. A worker who I'm hiring to pick apples, he can eat the apples as he is picking them, and I can't tell him, you're not allowed to eat the apples. To me, sort of, it's worth just announcing the presence of Rabbi Krauss. Rabbi Krauss, I gather, learns here regularly. So you view him as just a person who you see and don't appreciate. I want to note my appreciation of Rabbi Krauss. I don't see him all the time, but it's a pleasure to see him here. It's good to have a Torah scholar in the room. So what happens when I say to the workers, no eating the apples? Sounds like it's a sin. But here's my problem. I'm not harvesting apples. I'm harvesting persimmons. And persimmons are very valuable, and I'm afraid that my workers will do what?
Eat them.
And while they're entitled to their wages, they're not entitled to eat $500 worth of persimmons while they're harvesting. So I hang up a sign. I'm looking for workers to harvest persimmons. This is your wage rate, and there's no eating the persimmons while you're on the job. You must wear a muzzle. Wage rate is high. Can I do that? I would have guessed from the Gemara that the answer is no. But the Sma is insistent that that's totally and completely permissible so long as I do what?
Notify them before
then. When I hire you and then I say, here's your muzzle, that's wrong. But when I hang up a sign which says, workers with muzzles are needed, extra high pay rate for muzzle workers, there's nothing wrong with that. If you don't want the job, what will you do? Go somewhere else. Or you'll say, I'll wear a muzzle, but I want another $5 an hour. I want more pay. And I'll work out a deal with my workers. My workers will agree to whatever the deal is, and I will agree to whatever deal they want, and that's just fine. And the Sma says, "Va'aser lechosmo, afagav yafinik yichanaf shecha adim chasmo patur, haynu patur mimalkus, v'lo yafinu la mishor adim chasmo chayev malkus, aval iser alko panamiku miu, haynu dafka kishachosmo bal korcho, avalim matne imo shlo yachol, ein bo iser b'kach." But if I say in advance to him, "I'm hiring you with an understanding that you're going to wear a muzzle, no problem." And contemporary achronim sort of say as follows. In modern day America, when we hire workers, what do we say to them? No eating the food that you're harvesting. And once I have a common custom, the common custom becomes what?
Law.
Law. The common custom becomes like the law. Since everybody is doing this, then when you join me as an employee, you agree to whatever is the social norms. This is, of course, extremely important to understand. Because what this means practically is I now can go through every single area of commercial law and ask myself as follows. Can we modify this by agreement? Rabbi Feinstein, writing in 1950, confronts a fascinating example of this. He says rent control. How many of you are Manhattanites? Not enough. Okay? So in Manhattan, there's something called rent control. It's not unique to Manhattan, but it's pretty rare. Rent control means that after I rent an apartment to somebody, I can't evict them for no reason, and I can only raise their rent in certain governmentally sanctioned rates. I can't just raise the rent in whatever amount I want, and I can't evict them not for purpose, not for cause. So a person asked Rabbi Feinstein, can I rely on rent control to prevent my Orthodox Jewish landlord from evicting me? I'm an Orthodox Jew and he's an Orthodox Jew. The landlord says, this is my property, get out. I have private rights here. You have no right to invoke secular law. And Rabbi Feinstein more or less says, no, no, no. Everybody who does business in Manhattan in the 1950s does business in reliance on secular law. And everybody knows the secular law in Manhattan has rent control. And thus, every time I rent an apartment in Manhattan, I am implicitly agreeing to the rent control rules, and this is the common custom, and the common custom is binding, and it's as if I made a condition that we were doing law according to secular law. And the landlord wrote back saying, but these are Goyish laws. These aren't Jewish laws. There's no seven great leaders of our village that agreed to them. To which Rabbi Feinstein says, who cares? It doesn't really matter whether these are Jewish laws or non-Jewish laws. These rules come from society. And in America, the Jews and the non-Jews form one integrated unit. And since they form one integrated commercial unit, the rules that we agree to are the rules that we agree to, whatever they are, and I implicitly am doing law, doing life, according to the secular legal norms and not according to the halachic norms at all. Rabbi Feinstein simply shrugs off the Orthodox Jewish apartment owner's rights and says, no, 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 you surrendered your rights by agreeing to do business in a secular society in accordance with secular law. These two basic approaches are very, very, very powerful. One more or less says every condition, even conditions that run contrary to halacha, are valid when they address commercial matters, and every single human being does business based on the common commercial norms around them, rather than halacha. It's very interesting. 3 weeks ago, I was I davened at the Kotel Saturday night, and I stayed around with some friends, and then I ate shalashus, and we davened marim, and they said, take the bus home. Bus is coming in 15 minutes. And I said,
Shabbos.
No, Shabbos is over. Shabbos is done. I said, I don't have a Ravkov. Because I didn't bring my Ravkov with me when I came to the Kotel for Mincha. And they said, no, no, no. The minhag is that the first bus out from the Kotel, you pay later. The Kotel bus driver knows you don't have a Ravkov, and they let you go on credit. And the next time you go on a bus, pretend there are two of you and pay twice. Okay. Very interesting. There's no Israeli law that says this. I stopped to look. Of course there's no Israeli law that says this. What is there, though?
The custom.
There's a common commercial custom that the buses that pick up from the Kotel after on Motzei Shabbat are free. And the bus driver sort of trusts you, or the system trusts you. They let you board the bus, promising that you'll pay twice at some future time. Very nice, very Israeli. But it's not really nice, and it's not really Israeli. What is it? It's a custom. It's a common commercial custom in Israel, reflecting the fact that we're in an Orthodox Jewish society. They want to run buses from the Kotel Motzei Shabbat. They know nobody can pay. They don't want all these people walking, so they let you agree to pay later. This is sort of a common commercial custom that exists, that it's reflective of Jewish social norms, but it only exists because we as a secular society do this. Otherwise, when you go on the bus and you don't pay, what are you? You're stealing. It's an act of thievery. To go on the bus and not pay with your Rav-Kav is an act of theft. When the government says, here we're not machbid, and you get on a bus and nobody pays, so then it's not theft anymore, because the government has chosen to run buses in this way with a well-established policy that people are happy to talk to you about, that you promise to pay later. This is called a minhag ha-sochrim. There's all sorts of minhagei ha-sochrim that run in America and that run in Israel that are very interesting and fascinating, and they obviate the prohibition of thievery. Going on the bus without paying is theft. But when there's a well-established policy, which is we let you ride on the bus with the promise that you'll pay at another time, that's not theft at all. That's the minhag ha-sochrim that everybody knows about and everybody uses. Now, in New York, these are all established by general society. In Israel, these are all established by a Jewish society. Sometimes the Jewish society is the Knesset. Sometimes the Jewish society is the Supreme Court. Sometimes the Jewish society is the minhag of the community that you're in. It doesn't really matter. And by the way, when you step into Jewish societies, even in America, you see idiosyncratic reflections of this. In New York City, there's a well-established rule which says no temporary structures erected in public areas, but there's a well-established minhag ha-sochrim exception for Sukkot. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why. It's designed to accommodate the needs of a part of the community so that people should feel welcomed. Minhagei ha-sochrim are a way of adapting the norms around you to the community that you're part of in ways that work in the real world. So Tanai Shebamamon and Minhag HaSochrim are sort of things that we all use all the time to carve out exceptions to the rules, or even exceptions that are so large that they become the rule. It's not an exception anymore. It's a loophole that you can drive a truck through, is what lawyers call it. If the exception becomes so large that absolutely normal people function day in and day out based on the exception, because the exception becomes the rule that we all live with all the time. Knesset makes such rules in Israel. The Supreme Court interprets such rules, and they serve a vital function for running a fully halachic society that doesn't really follow halachic commercial rules. So important to understand. This is the way we all agree that we're not going to follow halacha. When you buy an apartment in Israel, and after you buy it, you say, well, how do I do chazaka? Where's the fence that I'm supposed to build to signal that I really own it? The answer is, we don't do that. We don't follow the Mishnah's description of how to buy property. We instead follow the Ottoman description of how to buy property, because the buyer is operating with that, and the seller is operating with that, and the government says that's the only way to legally buy and legally sell property. There's no reason to directly comply with halakha here. The next reason, of course, is more overt dina d'machlut d'dina. The halacha, the Gemara tells us that there's a general obligation to obey the law of the land. The Rishonim fight very intensely about why do we obey the law of the land. With five different theories given in the Rishonim, the Rashbam says that Dina Malchus Dina is a social contract. You agree to obey the laws of the land by dint of your participating in the land, and that's the social contract that we're out there. Rashi says Dina Malchus Dina is really binding through the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach of Dinim, which is secular society, makes rules, you all buy them. You all buy into them. Rabbeinu Tam says it's grounded in the governmental authority to do hefker bez din hefker. The Marshal says something more broadly. He says, if we don't have common law that's out there, society turns into chaos. So we all agree that chaos is bad and we'll simply obey secular law. And the Ran says, the reason why we obey secular law is because if we don't obey secular law, the government will kick us out. Based on the Ran, there are a group of Haredi poskim who whisper that Dina de Malchus Dina doesn't apply in Israel, since this is our land and we can't be kicked out. There's no real halachic authorities who adopt this view. You sometimes hear it muttered. A muttered is what you say when you mean that this is a halachic theory, that when you ask who thinks this halachic theory is correct and normative, you see that nobody thinks this. Nobody thinks this. You could read it into the Ran that the Ran thinks this, but when you ask who among the contemporary poskim, Haredi or modern, thinks that this is actually the halacha, you don't find anybody who actually adopts the view which says there's no Dina no Malchus Dina in the land of Israel. So we have five competing theories as to why exactly, but whatever the exact theory is, it's clear that there is a well-established rule which says rabbinic Jews obey the law of the land as a general proposition. The magic, of course, is not in why. The magic is in what. What does Dina de Malchus Dina apply to? The Shulchan Aruch says it's only limited to our relationships with the government, like taxation, or bridge tolls, or other things where the government wants money from us. But the Ramah says something much broader. The Ramah says that secular law is binding on us any time and every time the government is doing something that it thinks is for the benefit of its citizens. Like, for example, a seatbelt law, where the government wants me to wear a seatbelt to protect me, or a helmet law when I'm bicycling around, or even a bankruptcy law that's designed to fairly divide up the assets of somebody when they are in default on many of their debts. And the Shach says the Ramah is correct only in situations in which the halacha would view adding to its baseline rules as a positive thing. The consensus of the poskim is like the Ramah, that Dina de Malchus Dina applies every time every time the secular law regulates l'tovat ha-medina. It regulates in order to make the place that we're living in a better place. Based on this, I sort of routinely tell people that secular law, when it discusses how you should conduct yourself, like wearing a helmet, or driving with your seatbelt, or any other activities that are established, governed by a clear and direct secular law, are binding as a matter of halacha. These are done with tovat ha-medina. It's done to make a better place. And the Ramah tells us that things that are done with tovat ha-medina are binding on us all the time. So even when I drive for a short period of time, I buckle my seatbelt, not even because I think it's a risk, but simply because it's a function of secular law. I try to be a law-abiding person. I try not to jaywalk, even when there's no traffic, simply because the secular law frowns on jaywalking, and the same thing is true for lots of other areas.
2 points with regard to that. First of all, let's say the seatbelt law. Wouldn't that also be applicable even according to the Shulchan Aruch because of all of the voluntary insurance issues and when you were dealing with government medical care?
Sure, could be.
That would be number one. Number two, though, by the same token that commercial practice and minhagim apply to halacha, so it should also apply to din malchuta. In other words, if you, just take your example, driving down the street, you know, a 1 minute drive where people generally don't buckle, let's say if people generally don't buckle and your local policeman wouldn't.
I agree with that as well. Minhag ha-sochrim applies to dina malchuta dina. Sort of, you'll discover this is apparent. You'll be speeding on the highway with your children, and your children will say to you, "Daddy, are we speeding?" And then you'll slow down. But your children are much smarter than you, which is, they say, "No, no, no, Daddy, we were speeding. Why were we speeding? The sign says 55, and we were going 70. And you'll try to thump how to explain to your children that you're a dirty, rotten criminal. Because that doesn't sound like the most appealing answer to say to your five-year-old, "Yes, you're right, Daddy's a criminal." It doesn't seem like right. And the right answer is, of course, too complicated for five-year-olds to understand. But the right answer is as follows. Sometimes we have well-established rules with common customs to violate them. Speeding is a classical example of this in the United States, which is we have a well-established custom of speeding. The speed limit posted in Atlanta, I don't know, many of you will come to Atlanta, there's a big superhighway down the middle of Atlanta called 7585. It's 12 lanes at some point. That's how big a highway it is. And the posted speed limit is 55, not even 65. The posted speed limit is 55. And people tell you that it's called 7585 because that's the recommended speed. Posted speed is 55. The recommended speed is the highway number is between 75 and 85 is the speed. But people ask me, so why do I speed? I say, because when you drive down this highway at 55, what do people do? They honk, or they give you what they politely call in the South the one-finger wave. And the minhag ha-sochrim is that people speed. So when I have a well-established custom that normal people violate dina d'malchusa dina, I think that that's okay. I agree. I'll give you an even harder example. For 20 years, I served as the chief ethics officer of a hospice in Atlanta. Jewish hospice, the largest Jewish hospice in Atlanta. And we had marijuana lollipops widely given out in the hospice. I'll tell you why. When you're dying, marijuana serves many good virtues. It's a little bit of an upper. It increases your appetite. It makes it more likely that you'll die happy. The long-term consequences of marijuana addiction seem relatively unimportant when you're dying of liver cancer in the next 90 days. Sort of, you'll ask me, what's the long-term consequences of marijuana addiction when I'm dying of liver cancer? The answer is, I don't have a long-term plan. And I don't really care. So we had somebody who distributed marijuana lollipops, and eventually somebody asked me as the chief ethics officer whether this was proper because marijuana lollipops are a federal crime. So I wrote as follows. There's a non-enforcement letter from the Georgia Attorney General on the use of marijuana by people who suffer terminal illness. Since there's a non-enforcement letter, that's sufficient to justify the minhag we have of giving out marijuana lollipops in a hospice setting. Because we have a well-established Georgia policy, which is we don't enforce the law in this situation. That's sort of an example of a minhag to permit something that in other constructs might not even be a violation, but it might even be a crime. We do develop minhag ha-sochrim to permit things that are even in other situations crimes, and not just things that are in other situations violations like not wearing your seatbelt. It's worth noting, though, as you return to America, it's the near universal consensus of American poskim that we scrupulously obey Dina de Malchus Dina in the United States. I always tell people that all of the four great halachic authorities in America said this at various times. They didn't speak uniformly about lots of matters. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Henkin, the Rav, and the Satmar Rebbe all at various points said this. These were not people who routinely agreed on every matter in America, but each of them said at various times in various places that part of the commitment to living in a Western democracy is obedience to the law of the land. The harder question, of course, about Dina de Malchus Dina is what to do when the Dina de Malchus Dina is substantially unfair. What to do when it's substantially unfair? And that's, of course, a harder construct. We recognize in Halacha that once Dina de Malchus Dina becomes a tool used to oppress us, at some point, I don't have to be a good citizen. It's 1938, and I'm living in Germany. I don't have to be a good citizen of the Third Reich. I just don't have to be. Not only do I not have to obey the anti-Jewish laws, I can speed. The Dina de Malchus Dina loses its force of law at some point when I live in an oppressive society, one in which the law no longer reflects what the poskim call equality in application. So you have to think really hard about what to do when you're living in an oppressive society, and how you function as an Orthodox Jew in those societies. That's much more complicated. God willing, you'll grow up and you'll go out there and you'll do business. Maybe you'll be lucky enough to only do business in Western democracies, but many people don't. 5 or 6 years ago, I wrote a little tshuva to somebody who asked me. He builds furniture in China. And here's the furniture business in China. They harvest wood from Russia, which they truck into China in violation of the Russian-Chinese treaty. But everybody does. You pay a bribe at the border, they let your trucks through. They bring them to the factory in China. They weigh the trucks in China. And then they weigh the trucks again. They weigh the trucks in Russia, then they weigh the trucks in China to make sure that what didn't happen?
Workers
didn't steal. You know, the workers didn't steal. A truck comes into his factory in China and it's been short-weighted, i.e. somebody stopped along the way and offloaded some wood. So he complained to his Chinese foreman and said, somebody's stealing from us. And that's an untenable situation. The foreman says he'll look into it. He comes back 3 days later. The foreman says, you're right. Somebody was stealing the wood from our truck. Don't worry, we killed the driver. It'll never happen again. If another truck comes in short-weighted, tell me, and I'll have the driver killed. So, a month later, another truck comes in short-weighted. He wants to know, can he...
Rat on the driver.
That's a pretty hard Shiloh. And the reason why it's a hard Shiloh is because you're living in a substantially unjust society. Figuring out how to function in a substantially unjust society is complicated. When you deal with sort of how do I function in the Sudan, or even how do I do business in Mexico, is simply more complicated and how I do business in a substantially fair society. And again, it's important to be honest. Not everything is perfect in America, and there's a certain amount of impropriety in every country, but more or less approximately, both America and Israel are just Western democracies. Israel is a little more corrupt than America is. You can see this by going on the web and typing the words corruption index. There's an organization that keeps track of corruption indices in various countries. Israel's a little bit more corrupt than the United States, but it's substantially within the framework of what we would call Western democracies. But if you start doing business in the Sudan or in Ethiopia or in China, you'll quickly discover that Dina de Malchus Dina in its application is much, much, much harder and more complicated because the fundamental law is unjust. So you'll spend tomorrow in your tiul going to the Knesset and the Supreme Court, and this will give you a place for understanding how these indigenously not Jewish institutions properly have a place in a halachic system. The Knesset makes laws. The Supreme Court interprets laws. The Knesset doesn't only make laws consistent with halacha, and we don't want it to. The Knesset's fundamental role is to create rules of commerce that facilitate commercial activity in the state of Israel. And those rules, even when they're not at all grounded in halacha, are totally and completely binding. Those are good things. Those create commercial laws that are outside the framework of halacha, but consistent with halacha. Questions? Anybody want to ask anything they want? This is your chance to ask commercial law questions. Confess that you don't pay your taxes, whatever.
What if the laws of the land are totally opposite of the halakha?
On commercial matters, we don't care. Lots of commercial laws are totally the opposite, in the sense of we don't have kinyanim in American law, or we have very different kinyanim. In commercial matters, it doesn't really matter. There's no opposite. The procedural rules required by halakha can be waived by either an agreement of the parties or a common commercial custom or a secular law. So, of course, it's the total opposite of halacha because it doesn't follow the halachic norms. Who cares?
But that in situations where the laws of the country are in conflict with laws of Dera Isa.
Like theft?
Theft.
Theft is, of course... So, again, Ramosha says that when I have a common commercial custom that I can take this without permission, that's not called theft. That's called we agreed to it. So it's important to understand that this is exactly what's going on here. When I have a secular law that impacts on kashrut, then we ignore it. But when I have a secular law that impacts on theft, halacha says we all have agreed to obey the secular law when it impacts on theft. And when it impacts on theft, it's as if I agreed that you can take this since we all agreed to it. That's why Rabbi Feinstein says I can't evict you from my apartment at the end of your lease, because the secular law says I can't, so I have implicitly agreed to that. That's exactly right. That's a very important example, but worth articulating.
So does this only affect commercial law, or it also impacts every single aspect of your daily life that would be interacting with going those
people? Well, like, give me an example. It impacts commercial law on the streets, not just commercial law like big business, but even commercial law like small business. I step into a Kroger's or whatever is your local supermarket and I drop the can of spaghetti on the ground. I can rely on the fact that in American law I don't have to pay for it, to walk away without paying for it, even though halacha might label that an act of theft. That's exactly right. Yes, that's extremely important. Theft is taking that which either I'm not entitled to by halacha to take, or I'm not entitled as a matter of secular law or common commercial custom. I was in Iceland for a conference 5 years ago. And when you go to Iceland, they hand you a rule book. It says when the temperature falls below 0 Celsius, you can take refuge in somebody's home under their porch without their permission, and you need to know that. It gets ferociously cold here, and if you're caught outside, here are a list of lawful things you can do to take refuge from the cold. What this means is as follows. Even though this is my property, we've all agreed that in time of exigency and need, you can come to it and sleep in my porch or hang out in my porch so that you shouldn't freeze to death. Even though it might otherwise be theft, we all recognize that this is agreed to by all for the sake of norms in our community.
My question was more sort of like towards, for example, going to the beach and stuff. just because there are norms of a society, wouldn't change the halacha, even though you would have to interact with that.
Sure. So I consciously haven't discussed Evan HaEzer topics. Commercial matters between a husband and a wife are governed by secular law sometimes. More than that, I don't want to talk about here. I consciously haven't discussed tzniut matters. Some aspects of tzniut are subjective. Some are less subjective. But, for example, an agreement between a husband and a wife that the husband says, I won't support you and you'll get your own job, halacha would very well recognize that that's totally and completely binding. And if that's the cultural norm around you, that would be binding as well. Classic example of that is the fact that in America we pay no attention to the text of the ketubah and we instead collect alimony when we get divorced rather than enforce the ketubah, because that's the minhag. That's the well-established practice in the United States. Please.
If a situation occurs, like in, I think it's in France, where an individual's not allowed to wear like religious garments on the street, so what would you do in a situation like that?
I don't know. It might be this is a slightly different construct. Here the government says you can comply with your religion totally and completely, but you have to do so secretly. There's an interesting tshuva from a group of halachic authorities in the 20s about prohibition, about whether I should make kiddush on wine or on grape juice in prohibition. Okay, it's an interesting idea. Here the government has said halacha might require that you cover your head, wear a hat. Okay, meaning if they said no head covering, that would be more complicated than when the government says you need to wear a head covering, no problem, wear a baseball cap. Wear a baseball cap. Sort of that's a more complicated conversation when halacha says here are three ways to do this and secular law says don't do that way. Generally, we accept that. A classic example of that is that Israel says when you have a choice between yibum and chalitza, what should you do? Chalitza, no yibum in Israel. There's no yibum in Israel. It's against the law. We generally recognize that secular law has the authority when halacha says here are two options. Secular law can say don't do that option, do this option. There's a famous tshuva from Rav Ovadia Yosef. He complains bitterly about the absence of Yibum in Israel. But nonetheless, there's no Yibum in Israel, and I think it's become well accepted that even the Sephardim don't do Yibum.
So are there any communities here that completely dismiss secular
law? Now you're asking me to be a sociologist rather than a halachic authority. Nobody lives in a total and complete vacuum. People ignore secular law to various degrees, but I can't buy and sell an apartment in Israel according to halacha. So if I wish to own an apartment, I wish to buy it according to secular law, because I can't borrow from a bank based on chazakah. I can only borrow from a bank based on registration in the tabut. So I it would surprise me if you encountered any societies that were totally and completely divorced from secular law in any way, shape, or form. It sounds like a recipe for disaster. Anybody else? Thank you all. Please, yes.
Yeah, what do we do with the concept of that if the government forbids even like a light minhag, I'm obligated to follow it?
Sure. So the answer is that's a reference to minhagim that are in Arachayim or Yoredeya. And it's nothing to do with commercial law. That's exactly correct. And most Rishonim understand this to be an act of anti-Semitism rather than a general government minhag that's devoid of any anti-Semitic overtones. Even in Arachayim matters, there's a group of Achronim that say if the government prohibits an Arachayim minhag with no anti-Semitic motives, we would obey that government edict. It's limited to situations in which there's an anti-Semitic undertone to this society, to this edict. Governmental regulations that impact Shabbos or Kashrus that are genuinely designed not to have any Jewish intent, but just incidentally along the way, impact on halakhic matters. I think the consensus of Postkin is that we would obey rather than we would not obey. And there are a few of these, by the way, with regard to kashrus, where the FDA has stepped into kashrus and said, don't do this. This is not safe. And kashrus agencies have, in general, stopped halakhic practices that the United States government says, please don't do this. This is not safe. The classic example is you can't buy in America udder, the whole. The government has good reasons why they don't want it sold. It's true, Yaradei describes the kashrus process doing it, and the FDA said, please don't do this. This is not really as safe as you think it is. It's not a good idea. And the minhag in America is we don't do any of these things for all of these good reasons. Hard to find anti-Semitic legislation in the United States. Let me just say that very directly. It's hard to find. I don't think so.
Okay, thank you all very much. Please have my email address on the handout. If you have questions, please feel free to email me.
My wife says I'm much less impressive in person than by email, and there's probably a lot of truth to that, so please reach out to me. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.